that's a large number, right? Basically unrealized revenues because of those deductions.
Lawmakers look at cutting obscure subsidies and tax credits to trim the budget. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, February 10th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Matsu Borough sends its septic waste to Anchorage, and some residents think that should change.
You don't build a house and ask to use your neighbor's bathroom for the rest of your life.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Want to know more about how you and your family may get help buying health care coverage or avoid a tax penalty? Go to getcoveredak.org or call 211. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, a nonprofit health organization.
Every year, the state of Alaska forgoes roughly $1 billion because of tax credits, subsidies, and fee exemptions. With the state facing a multi-billion-dollar deficit, the legislature is taking a closer look at those potential revenue sources. A report by the Department of Revenue identified more than $40 million in direct expenditures for reconsideration and another nearly $500,000 for outright termination. Among the potential cuts are a discount to cigarette companies for putting stamps verifying they've paid taxes on their packaging, and a corporate income tax loophole that could encourage taxpayers to move assets to foreign subsidiaries. At a House Finance Committee hearing today, Fairbanks Republican Steve Thompson described the report as a guide for legislators working to trim the state's budget.
I'm glad everybody's interest has peaked. This is going to be a valuable book to make people go back and take a look and see what kind of legislation we need to pass, what kind of legislation we need to repeal, and what we need to do to go back and review some of this.
Members of the committee, like Fairbanks Democrat Scott Kawasaki, seemed amenable to the idea.
That's a large number, right? The amount that's deducted, basically unrealized revenues because of those deductions.
Legislative and agency staff were careful to note that the value of a tax credit or subsidy may not be recovered in full if the measures are removed from the books. While a bill to repeal some of these credits and subsidies has not yet been introduced, legislators are considering the possibility of an omnibus bill that could remove multiple items at once. The report is in the first assessment of the money the state forgoes from credits and subsidies. The reporting process was created last year as part of a bill establishing automatic sunsets for indirect expenditures. A state Senate committee has advanced a bill that would exempt Alaska from daylight saving time. The bill from Senator Anna McKinnon moved from the Senate State Affairs Committee today. It would exempt Alaska from the annual time change beginning in 2017. That means Alaska would be 5 hours behind the East Coast instead of 4 hours behind from about March to November. Under the Uniform Time Act, the state has the authority to exempt itself from daylight savings time, but not to change time zones entirely. Former Democratic state legislator Ethan Berkowitz has entered Anchorage's mayoral race. He announced his candidacy to a small crowd in Midtown this afternoon. He's the ninth candidate to enter the pool. Berkowitz says he wants to focus on improving public safety and strengthening Anchorage's economy. He says solutions for Anchorage's problems will happen at the local level and through public and private partnerships. He hasn't held political office since 2007.
I think my time outside of politics has given me a perspective that's going to be extremely useful because it's given me a deeper understanding of what the fiscal needs are of the business community. And we're never going to solve Alaska's problems simply by relying on government.
Berkowitz says he'll also be a passionate advocate for education and tap into state and federal resources to promote his goals.
The first thing I'll do is I'll advocate for this. I'm going to try and find ways for us to get pre-K available to Anchorage's people.
The final filing deadline for the Anchorage race is on Friday. Berkowitz says he waited to file until former mayor and Senator Mark Begich decided not to run. Governor Bill Walker's administration is seeking a delay in a long-running tribal sovereignty case, saying it wants to form a working group to explore policy issues and potential alternatives to continued litigation. But the tribe's attorney says the state's request for a delay is just a ploy to get around its loss in court. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes reports.
In an email, Department of Law Assistant Attorney General Corey Mills said the state is looking at ways to improve the state's relationships with tribes and would rather reach out to stakeholders before launching further into litigation. She said a six-month delay would give the new administration time to consider other options, including a congressional remedy. Native American Rights Fund senior attorney Heather Kendall says her clients had hoped for a different approach from the new administration.
They're not happy with this. The governor had indicated before the election that he would consider dropping this litigation effort altogether. And this is clearly not the case based upon his recent actions. What he apparently is trying to do is put the case in limbo so he can look at potential congressional alternatives, looking for a political fix.
At issue is whether Alaska tribes have the same rights as lower 48 tribes to put land into trust, a protected status that exempts lands from state jurisdiction, including taxation. In the 1970s, the Department of Interior Solicitor's Office issued an opinion that congressional intent, as expressed in the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, was that Alaska Native tribes not be allowed to put land into trust. Four tribes and several individuals filed suit, and in 2013, the Washington, D.C. Federal District Court ruled that Alaska Native tribes retain their right to place lands in trust under the authority granted by Congress in the Indian Reorganization Act of 1934. In its motion requesting the delay, the state said it has a good chance of winning its appeal of that ruling. But Kendall says tribes won a solid court ruling that agrees with the tribes on all counts, and she says the federal government is on the side of the tribes. She says the state is just trying to delay the results of a ruling it has little chance of winning on appeal.
The state is seriously unlikely to succeed on the merits of an appeal. And that's why the state has now shifted ground and asked to suspend the briefing in the appeal itself.
The district court may deny the state's motion, allow a delay of 6 months, or a delay of some period of time less than 6 months. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Governor Bill Walker has pulled the name of an appointee to the Alaska Commission on Judicial Conduct. A spokesperson for the governor confirmed today that Jeff Landfield's nomination was being withdrawn because of disrespectful images posted to his social media account. She called the photos misogynistic. Landfield says he is disappointed and was not notified by the governor's office that his nomination had been revoked. Landfield currently chairs Anchorage's Federation of Community Councils. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Brent Sass leads the Yukon Quest as the first musher into Dawson City.
It's great to be here, but you know, my goal is never to be here first. You know, my goal the last 2 years has been to the finish line first, and that's still to happen.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. Artist, show us how you inspire Alaska. Apply now for an individual artist award. The deadline is March the 1st. Learn more at rasmussen.org/IAA. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
The city of Anchorage and the Matanuska-Susitna Borough are wrestling over the problem of disposal of the borough's septic waste. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, a borough waste treatment facility is years away, while the Anchorage's wastewater utility has had its fill of the borough's sludge.
Helen Munoz is a diminutive woman with an energy level that belies her 84 years. She's at a local Palmer coffee shop discussing one of the passions of her life, septic sludge, and how to deal with it.
Look at what we're doing to the ocean. Look what we're doing to Cook Inlet. Give me a break. Are people blind?
Munoz says too much human waste is going into Cook Inlet. Munoz, whose son still runs the family's A1 septic company, has been in a decidedly unsexy business since her family moved to the Valley from New York in the early 1970s. She says since that time, the borough has built new schools, roads, not to mention thousands of houses to meet a growing population demand, yet has neglected one basic human need, waste disposal.
You don't build a house and ask to use your neighbor's bathroom for the rest of your life.
Mat-Su has no borough-wide sewer system, although the cities of Palmer and Wasilla have their own sewers and treatment plants. Most residences in the borough have septic tanks, which must be pumped out every year or two, and the septic sludge, as it is called, is hauled to Anchorage in pumper trucks for treatment at municipal facilities. Mike Campfield, an environmental engineer with the borough, along with Munoz, is a member of the borough's Wastewater and Sewer Advisory Board.
The board in the past has recommended that the borough assembly pursue funding in the form of both a grant and a DEC-backed loan.
In December, the advisory board approved a resolution authorizing the borough to ask for a $22 million loan from the State Department of Environmental Conservation for design and construction of a sewage treatment plant in the borough. Campfield says there is still a long way to go on the project, but the arrangement the borough has with Anchorage Water and Wastewater Utility may be coming to an end. Brett Jokala is AWWU's general manager.
We don't have any deadline. We're not going to turn them off. But on the other hand, we're not in control of the timeline for reauthorization of our permit either.
Jokala says the utilities board wants to halt taking septage from the valley. He says that decision is driven in part by the status of the utilities EPA permit. Anchorage is one of a handful of cities with a water treatment waiver from the federal agency. The city's largest plant, the Asplund plant at Point Warrensoff, must meet 9 conditions that control toxicity to protect the marine environment. Jokala says the treated septage does not harm Cook Inlet's waters.
Once the discharge is mixed into the receiving water, it's essentially lost to our ability to detect it.
Yet the valley septage is not in the best interests of the city, he admits, since its volume may jeopardize Anchorage's permit, and that could cause expensive upgrades. The EPA permit is up for reconsideration, normally a 5-year process, although there is no final determination as yet. Meanwhile, the borough is making progress toward getting its own facility. Mike Campfield says 2 possible sites are being evaluated, and he expects a decision by April. Borough studies have determined that it is most economical to construct a facility that would also treat fluids that leach from the local landfill. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Former Governor Tony Knowles wanted to put honey buckets into a museum. 20 years later, experts meeting in Anchorage recently heard that they're not going anywhere soon. Johanna Urich reports.
Despite progress and billions spent building water and sewage systems, many villages in remote places like the Yukon-Kuskokwim region still haul water and use a bucket instead of a toilet every day. Bob White with the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation says that even in communities with water systems, buckets are the backup toilet when things break down or freeze up. It smells bad, and hauling it off is, well, icky.
We've tried for, 50 years to get rid of the honey bucket, and we're still using them, and we're reverting back to them in some communities due to engineering solutions that just are overpriced and don't continue to function in the long term without a subsidy.
The good news is that honey bucket villages don't have high rates of diseases associated with handling human waste. Tom Hennessy with the Centers for Disease Control says the real problem lies in diseases associated with not enough washing of hands and bodies when people are rationing their water because they have to haul it.
Specifically, those would be respiratory infections in infants, skin infections in people of all age, and then even severe bacterial infections like meningitis or bloodstream infections are more common in those communities that don't have piped in-home water service.
The challenge before experts attending the meeting held by the Arctic Research Commission and Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is there isn't enough money to build, repair, operate, and maintain centralized water and sewer systems in Alaska's small villages. The state and federal governments are short $70 million annually to meet the most chronic and emergency needs in the bush, and that's only the construction costs. That's why people are looking for cheaper options. Sewage lagoons are common in rural Alaska. Though cheaper than many systems, they're still expensive, and no one knows how well they work, where winters are long and temperatures cold. The studies have not been done. Even when the lagoon appears to be working, operating in rural Alaska can pose logistical challenges. Take Upper Kalskag, where the lagoon is drained into the river every fall, just before freeze-up and after the fishing season. John Nichols with Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium says even if the pump works and the lines are not leaking, there's still a major communications challenge because Lower Kalskag is a few miles downriver from where Upper Kalskag drains its lagoon.
And we found out the hard way that is really critical to have that public outreach, to make sure that everyone knows. Placing flyers doesn't get it done. We need to really communicate with both communities.
Many want to try using natural systems like wetlands and tundra ponds to clean the waste. Besides problems posed by federal laws like the Clean Water Act, there's also little data on how well this would work and the impact on wildlife and subsistence. Villagers already worry about the ducks they hunt, which swim and feed in sewage lagoons. Even if everything works in the sewage lagoon, there's still the huge problem of what to do with the sludge, the solid stuff that sinks and accumulates at the bottom. That technology doesn't exist in small bush villages. But here, there's some good news. Alaskans have an advantage when it comes to composting sludge. We don't have heavy industry, so the final product is not high in heavy metals like it is in the lower 48. Lori Aldrich with the state's Department of Environmental Conservation points to Fairbanks' sludge composting operation.
They sell out of compost every year. Every summer it goes up for sale and people grab it in a hurry for their gardens.
With less space for its sludge in the landfill, Kodiak is now building a composting facility. I'm Johanna Urich.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Alaska Pacific University is proud to announce the APU Promise Tuition Grant, a program designed to significantly minimize or eliminate out-of-pocket tuition expenses for Pell-eligible students. Deadline to apply is March 1, 2015. Alaska Pacific University, a private nonprofit committed to personalized experiential learning that incorporates Alaska as its principal classroom. More at 1-800-252-7528. This message is sponsored by APU.
Brent Sass was the first Yukon Quest musher to arrive today in Dawson City, the halfway point on the Yukon Quest Trail.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
The 200-mile stretch of trail to Dawson City is the longest between race checkpoints. Sass's team overtook Hugh Neffs when he blew through Pelly Crossing. Sass says he has been looking over his shoulder ever since, especially when overflow slowed his team just outside of Dawson.
When I got in that overflow, I was like, uh-oh, they're going to catch up to me right here. But it was like 15 minutes and I got through it.
If he crosses the finish line in Fairbanks, Sass will win the Dawson Award, 4 ounces of gold, valued at roughly $6,000.
Oh, the gold. Yeah, well, I'm not going to talk about it until I cross the finish line because I had a little incident last year. But it's great. It's great to be here. But, you know, my goal is never to be here first. You know, my goal the last 2 years has been to the finish line first, and that's still to happen. So there's a lot of work to do before then.
There are just over 500 miles of trail ahead, and the Alaska side of the race is known for its extreme weather, tough conditions, as well as 3 major summits. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, it's a balancing act for mushers to figure out how to get to Dawson with teams that can still hold up for the last half of the race on the Alaska side of the trail.
Alan Moore was explaining his race strategy when his alarm went off in the Pelly Crossing checkpoint.
It's about the same. Oh, it's time to get up. All right, I'm awake.
Moore says he's only slept for 2 hours since the start, but because of the shorter mandatory layover in Dawson City, his team has had more rest than it did 2 years ago.
We figured that we probably need a little bit more rest going into the 24 instead of the 36.
Moore says he's not so sure about his fellow competitors' plans.
It's going to be something to see at the end of the race who has what left with these teams, you know, a couple of them, especially running 100-plus miles legs.
Early on, Jeff King ran his team for 100 miles straight to Braeburn. Hugh Neff ran over 100 miles straight between Carmax and Pelly Crossing. But Tagish musher Ed Hopkins says he's intentionally underrunning his dogs.
Whenever they feel like they want to really take off, I'll just stop. And I'll just let them roll around until they'll take off again, slow, 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 and they'll start climbing, climbing, climbing. And so when it's time for me to let it go, I'm just going to let them go.
Hopkins says that time won't come until after he's crossed the Alaska border. It's the kind of plan experienced Quest mushers execute well, which is frustrating for well-known Iditarod musher and Quest rookie Ray Reddington Jr.
Because, you know, like an Iditarod, I kind of know where I'm at now all the time. Where here, you're just hoping you find the next spot, you know.
More than half the race still lies ahead. The trail includes three major summits, and it's notorious for both jumble ice and overflow. Whether banked rest or early long runs will pay off when teams finally get to Alaska remains unclear. On the Yukon Quest Trail, I'm Emily Schwing in Pelly Crossing.
Seabirds are on the decline in the North Pacific from the Western Aleutians to Vancouver Island. Scientists with the U.S. Geological Survey compiled and filtered the data of hundreds of thousands of surveys of different species conducted in the last 40 years to document the decline and say it could signal a drop in the overall productivity of the ocean. Gary Drew is a wildlife biologist with the USGS. He spent more than a decade compiling the data set with a colleague. He says the overall trend was a decrease in seabird biomass of about 2%, but the decline varied from species to species.
When you take 40 or 50 species and you lump them together, they are not all declining. They're not all declining the same way. Some species we know, like the Kittlitz's murrelet, are declining faster than we're seeing in this broad trend. And there are other species like short-tailed albatross that are doing better. The reason they're doing better is primarily because we've instituted some constraints on the fishing industry, limiting the number of them that get caught during fishing operations. There are just some simple tools that they've come up with to scare birds away from, say, long lines as they're going into the water and coming out, that keep the birds from getting caught in all the machinery and getting caught on the hooks there. So there are many things that contribute to each species' general trend, but we were interested in looking at this more like a black box. You take energy in, you get energy out. You look at trophic levels, energy is moving through it. So if we looked at seabirds as a group en masse, you know, what are they doing? And what this suggests to us is that there's something, some underlying factor that is causing this decline. Now, one thing we did do was we did look to see if we split this up into birds that are eating zooplankton, or birds that are eating small fish. Some birds are specialists on one, some are specialists on the other. If you looked at those two groups, since they're foraging at different trophic levels, you might expect there to be some difference in how they are trending. And unfortunately, or fortunately, we found that there was no difference in that trend. They both were trending down.
What about other factors? Can you tie the decline or at least possibly some of the decline to other trends in the weather or in the ocean, temperatures, that sort of a thing?
None of the climatic indices that we looked at seem to do a very good job of explaining any of this. One thing we did do, though, was we looked at the food supply. There's a metric that's been collected for many years, and it's the small mesh trawl data that's collected cooperatively through NIMFS and ADF&G. And those two groups together would go out, they would sample with a very fine mesh trawl, then they would just pull it up. They would count zooplankton, they would count forage fish, and they would get an idea of what was happening with the smaller fish and zooplankton in the area. We found that we did have a correlation between the food supply and the birds. So we didn't expect it to be a great correlation, but the fact that it was there at all is significant and suggests that it may have to do with some level of productivity that's happening in the food supply.
How worried should we be about this trend?
Well, I'm always worried, but we did a calculation on the slope, and what we got was a slope of about 2%. So we were seeing a decline of about 2% of the total biomass through time. That's not a real fast decline. So I'm always worried, but I'm also hopeful, and we're also hoping that by throwing this out there that more people will be working in these areas and identifying the factors that are really behind these trends.
Gary Drew is a wildlife biologist for the United States Geological Survey. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ann Hillman, Ellen Lockyer, Jacqueline Estes, and Johanna Urich in Anchorage, and Emily Schwing on the Yukon Quest Trail. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. Artist, show us how you inspire Alaska. Apply now for an individual artist award. The deadline is March the 1st. Learn more at rasmussen.org/IAA. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation. The 2015 PFD filing season is here. If you have questions about your absences or someone you know away at college or serving in the military, the State of Alaska Department of Revenue encourages you to be proactive. Check out the absence guidelines before applying for your PFD. Visit pfd.alaska.gov and click on eligibility in the banner to learn more. The deadline to apply is March 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Want to know more about how you and your family may get help buying health care coverage or avoid a tax penalty? Go to getcoveredak.org or call 211. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, a nonprofit health organization.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.